All right, so as I mentioned, tonight we are going to be looking in the book of Acts, chapter 25, as Paul is making his way eventually to Rome, where he will end up as we close out the book of Acts. We're getting near the end here, and so I hope you will continue reading and thinking about these things. In our last study, as we think about and preparing our minds for this one, the first thing we discussed was in chapter 24 about the Paul there awaiting, is kept in custody to await a hearing before King Agrippa, 24, 22 through 27, and then as we closed out last week, we looked at chapter 25, verses 1 through 12, where Paul makes his appeal to Caesar. Now, you may remember, we've discussed how as a Roman citizen, Paul had special rights as a Roman citizen. One of those was he could appeal his case to be heard by the Caesar, by the emperor, and that's what he does as we close out that first section in 25. And so you also remember at this time you've had a change in leadership. Felix is no longer the governor, but now it's Festus. And then as we get into tonight's study, as Festus being the new governor, proconsul of this area in the surrounding area around Caesarea, he has a visitor, King Agrippa, and his sister Bernice come to visit and to, you know, of course, to show the proper honor to Festus as the new governor. And then in the midst of that, the topic of Paul comes up, and that leads to in chapter 26 where Paul will actually defend his faith once again, this time before Festus and more directly toward King Agrippa. And we'll talk more about that in just a few minutes. And then if we get there in chapter 27, Paul will then begin his journey toward Rome by ship. He will sail across the Mediterranean, verses 1 through 12. As you get in later in chapter 27, they get into some difficult weather, and that eventually will lead to a shipwreck that will occur off the Isle of Malta. But we'll get there, if not this week, then next week. So as we begin, let's go to chapter 25, verse 13. It's a little longer section, but I really didn't know the best way to break this up. So let's just read 13 through 22. Someone want to read that for us?
And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, you will hear him.
All right, so thank you, Sandy, for reading that. A little longer section there, but you have King Agrippa and Bernice have arrived again, to pay homage, or to pay honor, I guess you should say, to Festus. And Luke lets us know it's been he's there for a while. We don't know how long it is, but eventually the case of Paul comes up. Now, you have Festus kind of recount all that's happened. He makes a statement that, he says that in verse 15 that the chief priests want to do what? They just want Paul to be found guilty and given over to them, right? What's Festus' response? I can't do that. That's a violation of Roman law. And he's not just a Galilean or a citizen of Jerusalem. He's a Roman citizen. He couldn't do that. Well, one of the rights of a Roman citizen was to face to be able to meet face to face with his accusers. Now, has Paul been able to do that yet? No. Why? He has been put in trial once, right, by Felix, but he didn't meet his accusers, did he? Who were his accusers? Who? I'm sorry, Doug. I'm here.
Tertullus and some other Jews who came to stay in case against him before the high priest.
Well, yes and no, but Tertullus was, they were representing the Jews, but the actual ones who brought the accusation were the Jews from Asia. If you remember, Paul even mentions that when he stands before Felix. He's like, where are those who accuse me? They're not even here. They should be meeting me face to face. So even up to this point, even though Paul has been technically tried, he hasn't got to meet his accusers face to face. And so that point is still very true. Now, of course, what did the Jews really want? They wanted him brought to Jerusalem. Why? They were going to murder him, right? That was their whole goal. They wanted to murder him. And we made this, I mentioned this last week, you know, the whole fact that Paul is still in custody may be the providence of God here. Because had he been released, the Jews very well could have murdered him somewhere. And so in some ways, this custody may have been the providence of God. I can't say that definitively, but at least offered him some protection from those Jews, especially being in Caesarea. So anyway, he lays all this out. There's one thing I want to note here. You get down to verse 18, Festus confesses what? Up to this point, he's not heard anything deserving of imprisonment or any kind of punishment. He says, I like the way he says this, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. What's he saying? He was like, I'm waiting for it. Can you give me the big shocking moment? Can you do... Well, never mind, I'm going to say that. But, you know, they just could not deliver an actual proof or any even real charge to lay at his feet. Verse 19, he says, and you can see this from Festus' point of view, he's not a Jew. I don't even know if he's a religious man at all. But the whole debate between the two kind of goes over his head. He says, verse 19, rather they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. And so that really gets down to the crux of the issue. What's this really about? And Paul will point this out. Is it the idea of the resurrection? I think it's also interesting here that Festus, in discussing this, that word, their own religion, in the Greek carried with it the idea of demonology, right? And that kind of shows you his view of Judaism and Christianity, right? This whole idea of a resurrection, when we talk about demons. So he of course, doesn't seem to have a very high view of Christianity. Now, I wanted to... Don't do it to me again. I really wanted you to see this next one. Okay, it's up there. Let's see if it'll work. All right, so we got into the talk a little bit last time about who King Agrippa was, and I want to spend just a minute talking about the heritage of the Herods, right, and to give a little bit of historical information. Now, Festus, as we mentioned, is not the best source of, does not have the best source of understanding of Judaism, and definitely not Christianity. He's not that familiar with it. He doesn't understand its, the idiosyncrasies of the religion. But Herod is different. King Agrippa, and Paul's going to point this out, that he's really happy to in chapter 26, talk about these things to King Agrippa. And it's because King Agrippa was very knowledgeable about Judaism and also had some knowledge of the way, Christianity. Now, if we go back in this, we look at the Herods from a biblical standpoint. Now, when you think of the Herods, Herod is a title, not a name. As you talk to me, you call me Brian Hall, right? Brian is my first name. Hall is my family name. But that's not the way it works with the Herods. Herod referred more to a title. And this Agrippa is actually Herod Agrippa II. We'll talk about his dad in just a minute, but they have not been the friendliest to Christianity, or really, to even Jesus himself. Of course, we go back to Herod the Great. You can go back to Matthew chapter 2. It was verses 1 through 18 tell us about how it was that Herod who tried to murder Jesus because of the prophecy that he would be the king of the Jews. And out of his worry about that, I can't think of the word I'm trying to think of, but out of his concern about that, he tried to murder Jesus as an infant. This Herod the Great, was father to Herod Agrippa I, the father of Herod Agrippa that we're talking about here. And also, he was father to Herod Antipas. We'll talk about him in just a minute. So we remember Herod the Great, and then you have Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas was one of his two sons. He was the brother of Herod Agrippa I and uncle to Herod Agrippa II, Bernice and Drusilla. Those were the children of Herod Agrippa I. He is the one who beheaded John the Immerser, John the Baptist. You can go to Matthew 14, Luke 6, and Luke 9, all discuss how John was imprisoned and beheaded. You remember what happened with all that, with the daughter asking for the head of John the Baptist, because that's what her mom wanted, because her mom hated John. But Herod Antipas was the Herod who took care of him. And then you have Herod Agrippa, his brother. He was the father of Herod Agrippa II, the one we're talking about here. Anybody tell me what he did, what he may be noted from a biblical standpoint? You go to Acts chapter 12. He is the one who beheaded the apostle James in Acts chapter 12. He murdered James. And then what happened to him after that? Anybody remember? He was eaten alive by worms. So he died And that's how King Agrippa, that we're talking about here, took over the Herodship from his father. And so Herod Agrippa, the Herod we're talking about, just a couple notes, reminders, trying to create this family picture for you. He is the son of Herod Agrippa, and he's also the brother to Bernice and Drusilla. Who's Drusilla?
She married to Felix.
Yes, she was the one married to Felix in the previous chapter. You go back to chapter 24, that Drusilla was the sister of Bernice and Herod Agrippa the second. Let's see. And he's the one who hears the defense of Paul. Now, I want to talk just a minute about Bernice. And this all plays into chapter 26. I know you may say, this is all boring. Why share all this? This is all part of it. But who's Bernice? Well, Bernice was a woman who had a long history of incestuous affairs. By the age of 16, she'd already been married twice. First time to Alexander of Alexandria, and then to her uncle, and we haven't talked about, the king of Calais. So she was in that incestuous relationship. Well, now she's currently in an incestuous relationship with Herod Agrippa II. Family problems. You could create a drama show off of them, definitely. She would later on go on to become the mistress of Vespian, the Caesar Vespian, and his son Titus. Titus actually wanted to marry her, but because of the uproar it would cause among the people because of who she was, he didn't do that. She was just his mistress. So that kind of lets you know the cast of characters that are going on here. And so it's before those two that Paul will have his defense heard again. So let's go down to verse 23 and let's continue reading. Somebody read 23 through 27, please.
So the next day, when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at Festus's command, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa and all the men who are here present with us, ye see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. But when I found out that he had committed nothing deserving of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not to specify the charges against him.
Okay, so you've got Paul having his case heard, but it's not in some little quiet back room, just with the king and Festus and Bernice. It is in the main hall, right? And there is all the military. You know, you've got the military in there, the prominent men. And this place is crowded, full of people. And then you've got King Agrippa and Bernice coming in with all their pomp, right? All of their litany of whatever they're bringing in with them. This isn't some quiet affair. And one of the interesting things is I want to counter. So you have King Agrippa and Bernice coming in all their array and all their fancy attire, with all of the things that come along with a king, and they're coming in and sitting down. When they come and sit down, then you have this man Paul brought in. You're going to have a very different This is a very different appearance than those two, right? So you got Paul coming in, you got them coming in all that array, and then you have Paul coming in. You have this man who has been beaten down, a man in chains,
probably ragged clothes.
Probably so. I mean, and he's coming in there, and as he's walking, you know, when they came in, you may have had trumpeters or whatever calling them in. When Paul comes in, it's the sound of chains, right? Slapping on the floor. It's the sound of the chains of his hands. And this is going to play a part when we get into 26, but just two very different ways to enter. I think I've mentioned this before, but several years ago, I heard a man do a study of this passage. It was just, and he took you back there, and you were there in the moment, and it was so awesome. But just counter-supposing those two groups together, and here they are meeting. And, of course, Festus welcomes everybody. He lays out what's going on. I think it's interesting that, again, he states, "I found nothing deserving of death." And he makes the statement at the end of verse 25, had he not appealed to Caesar. Now, whether this is true or not, whether he would have done it or not, I don't know. But he says he might have gotten to go free. But he does note here, verse 27, it does, "For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, not to indicate the charges against him." It actually was the law. It's not just unreasonable. He had to do that. That's why he's going through all this. He's got to figure out what to write to charge Paul with. And so it's with that we get into chapter 26. And then Paul is actually going to get to speak. If we go to 26 and verse 1, the text tells us, "So Agrippa," I think it's interesting, it's Agrippa here who speaks up, not Festus. "Agrippa said to Paul, 'You have permission to speak for yourself.'" And so King Agrippa gives him that permission to go ahead and speak. And then in verse 1, Luke says, "Paul stretched out his hands and made his defense." And you imagine that man who is chained up, raising up his arms. Now, he's going to use that later. Paul's really good with using symbolism. But he raises those arms up. And again, you can imagine the sound of that, right? Being there in that room and hearing the chains come up and what that might have sounded like. And so he begins to make his defense. And we begin to look at that. In verse number 2, Paul says, "I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, I am going to make my defense today against all the accusation of the Jews, especially because you are familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently." So again, Paul notes that he's really excited that it's King Agrippa that will hear his defense here. Now, what I also think is interesting is Paul doesn't really, well, we'll talk about it in just a minute, but he doesn't really go out of his way to defend himself, but he just lays out exactly what his faith is and why he's living the way he is. And so he says, I beg you to listen to me patiently. He knows he's got a lot to say. So it begins in verse 4. If you go down to verse 4, he says, "My manner of life from my youth, spent from the beginning among my own nation and in Jerusalem, is known by all the Jews." So Paul says, you know my history. I haven't been hiding. It's not like I just showed up on the scene. King Agrippa would have been familiar maybe with the name of Paul, or at least he's very familiar with the Pharisees. And the Jews, of course, would have known Paul pretty well, or at least heard of him. They have for a long time, if they are willing to testify that according to the strictest party of our religion, I lived as a Pharisee. And now I stand here on trial because of my hope in the promise made by God to our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly worship day and night. And for this hope I am accused by the Jews, O king. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? And so he's going to go through a little bit of his history. And he notes right away that he was trained as a Pharisee. Now, we've talked about that in the past. I won't belabor it, but we remember, you know, Paul wasn't just trained as any Jew, but he was trained under the, the strictest of all of the Jewish belief systems, the Pharisaical one. He learned at the feet of a man named Gamaliel, a famous teacher of the day of the Pharisees. And he notes here again, he brings up this idea. He says, I'm on trial for what? Verse 5. I'm sorry, verse 6. I'm on trial for what?
Hope
of the promise made. Now, we've noted in the past, the major difference between Pharisees and Sadducees is what? The resurrection, right? That's really a huge sticking point between Pharisees and Sadducees. But he notes here, I'm on trial because of my hope in the promise. What promise is he talking about? Well, he doesn't say exactly, but it seems to be to indicate the promise given to Abraham in Genesis 12. And we've noted those before, but the third of those promises and the ones that the Jews continually went back to was the messianic promise to Abraham, saying, through your seed, through your lineage, through your family, I will bless all the families of all the nations. And of course, the Jews, even of that day, saw that as the messianic prophecy. Now, how they viewed the Messiah was very different. But it was the watching for and awaiting the coming Messiah. And so he says, that's why I'm on trial. Now, what does he mean by that? I think this really gets at the heart of the book of Acts, if you really want to think about it in a deeper way. He says, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain, talking about that messianic prophecy through the line of Abraham, as we earnestly worship day and night. All right, and it's for this hope I am accused, O king. And then he gets to verse 8. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? Looking back to the resurrection. All right, so that's kind of an introduction for Paul. Then he's going to go into kind of his history. And now he's already noted he was a Pharisee. We know and quite a bit at this point about his history at this time. But Paul recounts in verse 9 what he was doing prior to his conversion. He says, I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things in opposing the name of Jesus Christ. And I did so in Jerusalem. I not only locked up many of the saints in prison after receiving authority from the chief priest, but when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. And I punished them often in all the synagogues and tried to make them blaspheme. In raging fury against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. So he says, that same passion that you or those Pharisees have for the church to destroy it, I had the same thing. I was just as anti-Jesus Christ as anybody. I was there. I was going out. I was going into their homes. I was taking them prisoner. He even makes a statement in verse number 10 that when they were put to death, he cast his vote against them. maybe inferring that Paul was actually on the Sanhedrin himself at one point. And so he says, that's where I was. So he paints that picture in verses 9 through 11 to get to verse 12 and following. So he says, I was a vehement opponent of the way, of the church. And then he says in verse 12, in this connection, I journeyed to Damascus with the authority and commission of the chief priest. So he says, I was doing their work. I was their military arm, if you will, their police arm. They would give me the orders, I would go. Right? I was commissioned to go to Damascus. Verse 13, at midday, O king, I saw a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, that shone around me and those who journeyed with me. And when we had fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. And I said, Who are you, Lord? And the Lord said to me, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But rise and stand upon your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant, servant and a witness to the things in which you have seen, you've seen me, and to those in which I will appear to you, delivering you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. And so he again recounts the events of his conversion to Christianity. Now, of course, we've studied about this in chapter 22 and in chapter 9. I do think it's interesting each time. Of course, in Luke 9, it's Luke telling us what happened. In Acts 22, it's Paul telling us what happened. And in Acts 26, it's Paul telling us. And in both accounts, it gives us, he frames it in a little different way. He gives us different information each time. Of course, the point of this recounting is what? What's the focus of what he's saying to King Agrippa here? Go back to his introduction. He said, why am I on trial?
Because of the hope that he has.
Because of the hope.
Resurrection. He believes in the resurrection.
Yeah, so it's the hope of the resurrection. And he says, that's why I'm on trial. Now, why is he giving him this information? Why is he talking about his conversion in this way? Well, it's with that in mind. He's trying to talk about this idea that here is Paul, this Pharisee, this anti, wanting to destroy the church man because it's teaching this false theology about Jesus being the Messiah, the anointed one from God. I was that man. I was over here and I was trying to destroy it. But I saw the light. Jesus appeared to me, and I was changed. Why does he bring all that up? Look at me. I was as anti-Christianity, anti-Jesus Christ, as any person could be. Now look at what I've done since that conversion. Doesn't that say something to you about what happened to me that day? And about how I was changed? You know, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 2, Paul says, and it's in a discussion of baptism and why he... how people were breaking themselves up into whatever disciple they thought they were. Paul said in verse 2, he says, I therefore wanted to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. At the heart of the gospel message, at the heart of everything we do, is the resurrection. He says that's what makes all the difference. There have been all kinds of men who claim to be the Messiah. Even today, in the 21st century, there are some Jews who believe that there's this guy in Jerusalem who's supposedly resurrected, and now he's the new Messiah. That's still going on. But what they failed to catch and see was the importance of the resurrection of Jesus Christ and how it separated him from all those others. And I believe that's what Paul's point is. And so Jesus sets him on this mission. He says, I've appeared to you for this purpose, to anoint you as a servant and witness. And so Paul is saying, I then became a servant and witness. I then followed that out. Let's go to the next section here, and we'll probably have to end on this. I'm sorry. I don't know why that keeps going out for. So we go down to verse 19. He goes on to say, therefore, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but declared first to those in Damascus, then in Jerusalem, and throughout all Judea and all the region of Judea, and also to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds in keeping with their repentance. For this reason, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. To this day, I have had the help that comes from God, so I stand here testifying both to small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass, that the Christ must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. And so Paul says, if you don't want to take my word for it, if you don't want to think about my own conversion, I want to take you back to Moses and the other prophets. What's his point? This is what they've been talking about. Instead of being angry at Paul, what they should have done is done their own investigation into the Word of God. He says, I am doing what I've been called to do, and what I can prove to you by the Scriptures. He says, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but I declared at first those in Damascus. And we go back and we can look at what we've studied. You know, it was in Damascus he was converted. It was in Damascus that he began to preach. He went down to Jerusalem. Of course, they didn't want him there. So he ended up, Barnabas ended up coming in and helping him out during that time. But Paul says, I did those things that I was called to do, and that's all I've tried to do. And that I have done to proclaim both to the Jews and to the Gentiles. We'll stop there. I know it's time. I know it's a lot of information. I'm sorry. I try to make it as interesting as I can. But I think there's a bigger point here that we need to understand about what Paul's saying to us about the mission of Christianity, of the Gospels, and how the resurrection of Jesus Christ is our ultimate hope. And it's the resurrection that separates Jesus from all these other false messiahs, all these other false ideas and religions. He is our hope. Next week, we'll finish up chapter 26. We're almost done tonight. Then we'll get into 27. And we're getting close to the end of this study, and we'll be looking towards something else. Thank you all so much. We'll be dismissed.